This is the Automotive Repair Podcast Network.
Welcome, everyone, to yet another episode of Diagnosing the Aftermarket A to Z. I'm Matt Fonsla, and ambition is a very dangerous thing. Because either you achieve what you set out to do and your life ends prematurely, or you don't, and your life is a source of constant disappointment. That and more after a word from our sponsors, Pico Technology and Autel. Tired of guesswork in your auto diagnostics? Need to pinpoint faults quickly and accurately? PicoScope will turn your PC into a powerful diagnostic tool. See live waveforms from sensors, injectors, and ignition systems. See the problem? Solve it faster. Visit PicoAuto.com. That's PicoAuto.com. Autel delivers award-winning automotive diagnostic tools trusted by technicians across North America. Backed by Autel North America experts in sales, training, and technical support. From drivability diagnostics and TPMS service to ADAS and advanced safety systems, Autel helps technicians follow OEM procedures and repair with confidence. Learn more at autel.com. For today's episode, I thought I'd talk a little quick bit about a vehicle that was in the shop that I found kind of cool, but I'm easily entertained. And then maybe answer a couple of emailed questions, seemingly unrelated, which ends up kind of right up my alley. So to start out with, we had a 2000 Ford Excursion with a 7.3 liter power stroke VIN F. Most of you now have shut the podcast off. I'm sorry, but I'm not all about diesels, nor am I against them. I don't care. It's broke. And I want to figure it out why. In this case, it initially came in lack of power. Not that this is so important to the interesting bit, but had a complete lack of power, would hardly get out of its own way. And it started up every time, though. I mean, there's not a lot to tell with this part. I guess what I would say is if I'm going to call him an apprentice, mentee, we'll call him a mentee, not manatee, mentee. One of the techs I'm kind of mentoring did a fuel pressure test and he said it passed. And we're talking about the low side. So not to go into like a big theory and operation of Ford Power Stroke engines or the Navistar power plants, but these use a lot of hydraulics using engine oil to fire or shove the diesel fuel under extremely high pressure into the combustion chambers. So you could think of each injector as having kind of a chamber that fuel is pumped into, and then a piston controlled by an electric solenoid that controls engine oil pressure to it. And this is very high oil pressure. And this piston, I think it's called an intensifier piston. And I think it's like to the tune of 10 times in intensity. So whatever pressure is on one side, it's 10 times that on the other side. Okay. So you're not really looking at high pressure fuel. It's really not like current common rail type of fuel deliveries. You can look at oil pressure and the high pressure rail, what the oil pressure is there, and maybe infer what the pressure could be going into the engine. But other than that, you have to really make sure that the pressure on the low side is good, which my mentee, if you will, said he verified. The issue is, when did he test it? Cranking or key on engine off or key on engine running at idle. Didn't test it when the actual symptom was arising. And I don't know if you guys pay much attention. You don't have to, but what started out is just me sending a video to a couple of friends, just something I thought was kind of cool. I ended up sending in, I was asked what I was doing that day and I sent that video, just thought nothing of it. Next thing you know, it's online. And I don't know, just kind of something to do, right? See something kind of cool or think of something interesting and post it up. Well, the latest one was displaying some diagnostic equipment, if you will, right? And one of my diagnostic carts with PicoScope on it, and I have my Megger because I just can't bring myself to buy a straight up voltmeter, Autel power probe, if you will, or I don't know, is that a patent issue, copyright name? I don't know. But their version of a Power Probe and a Vantage Pro. And I was kind of talking about, like, there are times we need that stuff. And I suppose you could go after me on needing a Power Probe, but, you know, in the right hands, they save us a lot of time, right? And I do like it. I do use them. Do I understand people can wreck stuff with them? Yeah. The other thing is all the other equipment is it may not break anything on the car, but we may slam new parts on a car it didn't need or replace perfectly good parts. So, I mean, I guess everything's got its caveats. But to get to the point, I also showed a array of other test equipment, like my U-test leads from AES Wave. I showed various lights, meaning bulbs. I think a 194, 3157, a couple of sealed beam headlights for circuit load testing. Well, we test things under load. We test things when they're stressed, when they need to really work. And that was the issue with the fuel pressure, was it wasn't tested under duress or high load, high flow. So he could have went and drove it. I had him just quick run the line right into the fuel tank. So a long, clear line and do a flow test. There isn't a lot of really good, like an official Ford spec, at least that I found. And maybe there is, but it was well under a half a gallon a minute, which I find to be absurdly low. Pull the fuel tank down, pull the sender assembly out as the low pressure pump on this is on the frame rail. And you could see that the pickup screens had self-destructed. Like they're just, you know, it was mass chaos in the fuel tank, just debris everywhere. So we ended up cleaning out the fuel tank and replacing all that stuff, and that fixed that issue. But then it had a new issue and or a different issue or another issue on top of it. And that's the part I thought was kind of cool. This is the part that I thought was neat. You could go drive it and it would set. I'll get into more details, but there's times you would start it up and it would not have good power on acceleration. Fuel pressure, of course, is very good now, but it would set a P1280. Which is for the injection control pressure sensor low. You could look at that with the scan tool and never see an issue. It's very interesting. Key on engine off, that voltage on that sensor is like 0.3 volts. So 0.2 volts isn't very much. Really, it's 0.3. You've got it with a scan tool. It was 0.3 on the scan tool, on a meter, on a scope, at the PCM or ECM, technically, I suppose. PCM. It's 0.2 volts. That's key on engine off. And if you look at their chart, that's around zero PSI roughly. So it would have to go below that. So the line of thinking is maybe during cranking, that's when the pressure drops. So maybe this would set on startup. And that's what it really started to look like. Like you could get this, maybe not consistently, but you could get this to, I would say, quite frequently set the DTC after startup. So that's when you start really monitoring it. And, you know, with a meter, just trying to watch that voltage. And I tell you, on the meter, it never dropped. Cranking, it never dropped. And so I had my mentee checking this out with a scope, right? Hooks up Pico. Back probing the ACM, which kind of sucks per location, but you got to do what you got to do. We could have used a breakout box. I do have an EQ5 breakout box. It would have worked, but whatever. Got the signal. And he tried over and over and over. And he said he never saw it drop, even though it would set the DTC. So that gets really rough, right? Now you're thinking power feeds, grounds, maybe monitor 5-volt reference. And then if any of those drop, or, you know, do we have a ground failing under load? Do we have a feed voltage that's, you know, dropping a little bit or a lot, cranking or running? Same with the 5-volt reference. Is the 5-volt reference getting pulled down? The ICP, the sensor, is a 3-wire sensor. So it's got a 5-volt reference, it's got a ground, and it's got the signal wire, and scope all three of those. He's not finding anything. So it's late in the day. I decided to take a look at it, and I'm not sure what I'm going to see that he isn't, because, I mean, feels like he's has little choice but to replace the PCM. That's where we're heading. They are extraordinarily difficult to find, almost unfindable used. Brand new, I don't think there's new ones out there. There's reman ones from companies that reman modules, and if you know, you know. That's what I'll say about the reliability. If you know, you know. And so that just didn't feel like an option. So I went and looked at it. And no hero cape. I thought, honestly, it was just going to be like, verify that. And then, I don't know, pull the module apart and see what I could find. And I don't know. I mean, I do some circuit board level repairs, but to that level, like to diagnose something on the board that failed in that manner, like for me, that's daunting. That would be a very daunting thing. Might be calling Mike, and spelled M-A-I-C. Anyways, I go and take a look at it. And I kind of noticed something that I thought was kind of cool. And I suppose I should have made a case study out of it, but I don't know. I guess you don't think of it, because I don't know. I just want to figure out this freaking car or truck and get these people on their way. So anyways, I'm scoping and watching on a scan tool. And I noticed that cranking, running, when you started to crank, that voltage never went below that, this whatever you want to call it, that startup low voltage, 0.2, 0.3 volts. It never went below that. Cranking, I mean, it's getting a 5-volt reference. My line of thinking is if they're using whatever design, we'll just say, just for the sake of discussion, a Zener diode, that would voltage to the module would have to drop significantly for the voltage to the sensor to be affected. That never happened. Just extended crank, initial crank, when it should be drawn tons of current from the batteries, that voltage never dropped below. Never. And I wasn't looking for it. I noticed, so the engine was running, shut the key off, that voltage would dip, not just a little bit below 0.2 volts, almost to zero. It only did that key off. 5-volt reference never dropped. Ground didn't drop or go up, I guess. Lift. Ground never lifted. But sometimes, and again, not consistently, but repeatedly, after running, and didn't seem to matter how long, shut the key off, that voltage would drop. And then on the next key cycle, that DTC was there. Code set criteria doesn't go that depth. Honestly, it basically says it's looking key on, engine off, and running. I don't know if they even give you an actual voltage. I want to say if they did, it was like 0.15 volts, then it would set the DTC, which seems absurd, right? When actual key on, engine off is 0.2, that's a very, very narrow margin of error to trigger a DTC. But that's what I was witnessing. So, come to find out, the ICP is an aftermarket variety from a notable aftermarket company that I think makes very quality parts. Is your shop ready for the electric vehicle revolution? Don't get left behind. The Picoscope EV Kit is your all-in-one solution. Diagnose any electric or hybrid vehicle, from high-voltage batteries to complex communication systems. With guided tests and pinpoint accuracy, you'll tackle more jobs and boost your bottom line. This isn't just a tool. It's your future. Be the expert in EV repair. Visit PicoAuto.com to future-proof your shop today. That's PicoAuto.com. This episode of Diagnosing the Aftermarket A to Z is brought to you by Autel. Autel is a global developer and manufacturer of award-winning professional automotive diagnostic tools and service equipment, trusted by technicians, educators, and shop owners across North America. With diagnostics at their core, Autel's real-world solutions support repair workflows ranging from full-system vehicle diagnostics to servicing the most advanced automotive technologies. What sets Autel North America apart is the team behind the tools. Dedicated experts across sales, training, and technical support, each bringing deep, hands-on experience supporting professional technicians. When questions arise, you're working with people who understand the vehicles, the procedures, and the real-world demands of modern repair. Whether diagnosing complex drivability concerns, servicing TPMS systems, validating repairs, or working with ADOS and advanced safety technologies, Autel tools are engineered to support accurate, efficient repairs in strict accordance with OEM procedures and standards. To learn more about Autel and their diagnostic solutions, visit autel.com, AUTEL.com. But something with this sensor seemed to do something that I think the term could be wrong. I think the term is called inertial rebound. My introduction to inertial rebound was really with piezo sensors, particularly when I take that, I got to be careful with piezo sensors, right? Because we have a lot of those. I guess first look type sensors, the pulse sensors. So piezo type pulse sensors. First look, we have a couple of them out there made by like Joe Casey. I think D-Rail might make some. I could be wrong. I didn't get mine from there, I don't think. I got mine from another guy who doesn't make them anymore. But I got a couple from Joe. Joe's Electric. They're great. They serve a purpose. But my introduction to that phenomenon, if you will, was on the first look when they were really the only game in town. And we would call it like the rubber band effect, and a term that I will attribute to Aaron Keppen. It could have been Harvey Chan, but I really think Aaron's the one that kind of made that term, and we were using it for the longest time. But then through studies and all that, we find that there's something called inertial rebound. And on those, it's exaggerated because of the diaphragm inside of the sensors and the way they work. Like, it makes sense. But you don't think about it, or I wouldn't normally think about it on something like a pressure sensor of that sort, which I think the technical term for those would be a strain gauge. I don't know the guts of it. I don't think they're piezo. They might be. I suspect they're capacitive. I don't know. But I think what we're seeing is sensor rebound. The OE sensor, the Motorcraft sensor, did not do that. As many times as I tried to reproduce it, it wouldn't do it. Because it's easy. It's right on top, right? If I can replace it, anybody can replace it. Right on top, screw the new one. And Motorcraft doesn't do it. Put the aftermarket one back in, it does it. I wish I had way more time to kind of mess around with this and send maybe stuff to this supply. I should say manufacturer. It's Friday. People wanted to go. I get it. So what do you do? But I thought that was kind of cool that it was really setting on key off. As far as I could tell, I guess I don't know if I want to necessarily say absolutely, like I know for sure, but I think I have data that kind of backed up that this was setting on a key off. The sensor was rebounding from, you know, whatever idle pressure of 800 PSI. I don't think it was 1,000. I mean, it could have been in certain points, depending on when you shut it off after startup, because usually startup can be over 1,000, 1,500, I think. You know, after startup, it would be over 1,000 PSI, maybe 1,500 or so. And then at idle, it would come back down to roughly, you know, I think it was like 800, maybe 700. I want to say it was 800. And you shut it off, go to zero rather quickly. I don't believe they're supposed to hold pressure. I think we're seeing inertial rebound, and the PCM was awake to set the DTC. And if you weren't looking for it and thinking about it that way, which initially, no, I wasn't, you may never see it. And if you're not watching your scope, or even depending on the scan tool, if it's still collecting data after key off, some of them, once the key is off, they freeze, they're done. And then a couple others would kind of keep going. Not long at all, but enough to maybe capture that once in a while. It was the scope that caught it. It was the scope. And the meter never really saw it. Not that it was just such a fast signal, but I think it was a timing thing. And you got a few things going on with sample rate, if you will, of the meter. And then, of course, the display itself updating, right? Because if the meter's measuring 1,000 times a second, the screen's probably not updating 1,000 times a second, right? So I put in an OE sensor and fixed the problem. I thought it was kind of cool. But like I said, I'm very easily entertained. I guess that leaves us enough time to answer a listener question. Okay, so it's a neat question about what do I see an effect, negative effect of people, and I'm mainly talking about kids, with using artificial intelligence. Okay, so my take is that when we say artificial intelligence in normal conversation, almost everyone is talking about large language models. They're talking about ChatGPT, Gemini, Claude, Grok, Meta. I feel like I'm missing one, but those are some of the heavy hitters, right? Yeah, it's just like using database diagnostics, right? And not that people are necessarily always using AI for diagnostics, but just to answer questions. The repercussion is that you either kind of have that skill atrophy, or that area of your brain that stored that information kind of purging it, or you're losing how quickly you could access it, or I suppose technically access to it, period, in favor of using this intelligent or large language model. Okay. Be it to write a sentence, to write a paragraph, to write a thought, to run you through a diagnostic strategy, to have, instead of reading a bulletin from beginning to end, you just paste it in and ask for a summary. There's, I don't want to say danger, but you have to be aware of what's going on. So, do I think this is the fall of man? Maybe. The reason it's hard to get overly negative is it doesn't have to. We can choose for it to not to. And that could be us individually, us as families, us as businesses, us as industries, our professions, and then really honestly, us as a society deciding that we have to think about evidence-based across the board. That's how we have to default, evidence-based, and then question what are the long-term effects. Some things we can't know, but then why not proceed cautiously? But at some degree, I appreciate the freedom families have, parents particularly with their kids. I have to question sometimes if they're aware. Like, how do I assure all the parents quite know what they're up against with artificial intelligence? Because let's be honest, they know about social media. Are they restricting access of their kids to social media? And the answer is no. And we know the dangers. We know them. We know the repercussions, and it's not good. So yeah, I think as a society, we have to agree sometimes what is best and evidence-based, right? So then if we do kind of go down certain roads, there's a reason to do it, and it's backed by data, and it's hard to overly dispute to a degree, right? Everything's, the nature of science is to question everything. That's just what it is. But on the flip side, then you better question yourself too, right? So all that's to say, I want to see at least discussions, maybe not necessarily regulations, but I want to see really good discussions and somehow getting the word out to everybody about the fire they're playing with. And they should have with social media, and they didn't. And the information is relatively easy accessed about the repercussions of social media in children and young adults. So we should be having hard conversations about that and thinking about what to do about it. Because I don't know if just letting things fly and see what happens. I don't know. Trusting that things will work out. Then why aren't we doing that in our shops? You know, we do stuff to affect certain changes. So it's not so different. I think luckily some heavy hitters with the large language models have kind of gotten together, at least to help work together for AI detectors. Because some of the crop of AI detectors out there are god awful. It was nice to see that. But the reason I have a rough time, and maybe I'm taking too long to get to this point, I don't know. The reason I don't find it to be all doom and gloom is we can make choices to avoid certain paths. And there's something called neuroplasticity. And you've probably heard me bring it up before, especially if you've listened to episodes where I'm talking about substance use disorder and maybe some psychological stuff. Margaret and I may have talked a little bit about it, but I've talked quite a bit about neuroplasticity. plasticity either on this podcast or some of the other early ones with Carm talking about substance use disorder or addiction. And neuroplasticity, it basically allows for us that ability. Our brains allow us to rewrite things. So the dependence on social media, really what we're talking about, the dependence on large language models, that can be changed. Like, we have people or us or kids or whatever that lean heavily on it, and it becomes a crutch. They lose confidence in their ability to do something now that they have this resource available to them, that they now have to do it themselves and should have to do things themselves at least once in a while, or take more control about what's going on, that we can rewrite our brains. We can recover from this type of thing. It's just, how far are we willing to let it go? That's my answer. It can't be all doom and gloom. I'm not confident that enough people in the right places, and that could be at the kitchen table or in the household, are going to do, and maybe it sounds judgy, the right thing, but start asking real questions. I don't know where we kind of lost that confidence to make those decisions or to start asking the hard questions about the effects. It seemed to happen a lot with, you know, video games and television and all that. And now I don't know what's really questioned. Music too. Oh my God, music. If you listen, parents were very much against you listening to certain things. Maybe that was it, when they were found to be barking up the wrong trees with, you know, video games make you more violent. It was hard to find data to back that up. Watching television made you stupider. It was hard to find stuff to back that up. Although now I'm wondering, especially with me watching too much, maybe. At least I remember what I watch, I guess. I don't know if I watch so much, just I remember it. And then, yeah, the music with, what was it, the PMRC, that it just, it ended up not holding a whole lot of water. And you had heroes, I guess, with, of all people, John Denver and Dee Schneider going in, and amongst other artists, pushing them back against Congress. And the data didn't support, I don't know if it's so much Congress, maybe not Congress, but at least a committee. The data didn't hold. But we have data about social media. It's not good. We have data about large language models. It's not good. So I guess my first answer is my last answer. Evidence-based. Those are terms I would like to hear more and more of us refer to. Whatever that is. If I'm presenting you an idea and I think it's right, what's my data? And sometimes it's an opinion based off of a bunch of different pieces of data and experiences. But a lot of times I see these arguments where no data, there is no data presented to anyone. Or somebody brings about some data, and rather than counter it with data, we just try to undermine the sources of the data or laugh the person off. And depending on your political leanings and who the different people involved in the conversation or what the content is or the subject matter is, dictates your behavior is acceptable for the given argument. Meaning, I don't know, I see right-leaning or more conservative people doing the same thing more left-leaning or liberal people do. And depending on the subject matter, that's what seems to make it okay. So I don't know. Oh man, that's a circle, right? They think they're further apart, but they end up going around the other end and they're closer together. I don't know. Anyways, that is my answer. Evidence-based. And yeah, be careful with it. Neuroplasticity can offer the path back or path of recovery and gain those skills back. And we could be all right. And then, yeah, just start thinking in terms of evidence-based. What can I back this stuff up with? And maybe someone else's data, or you have to start gathering your own data and understand that your data probably has biases, and therefore the nature of science is to debunk your data and go about and find data that conflicts with your data using the same methods you are, and then coming up with other methods to get new data, better data, and then you can use that to find better, presumably better data That's how that works. And we can use it. We don't have to be scientists to freaking use these tools. The scientific method works for everything, or at least almost everything. We can use it. That is how I'll leave you. I'll skip Mount Rushmore today. Maybe next episode. A few people asking different things about different Mount Rushmores. Seems to be popular. If you do like it, let me know. I mean, I want to know that this stuff interests you and what interests you. And make sure to leave a comment. If you're watching this on YouTube, please don't forget to give the video a like. It really does help. And if you want to not miss future episodes, click that subscribe button. Thank you to our sponsors, Autel and Pico Technology. And thank you to the Auto Repair Podcast Network. And until next time, take care.
You've been listening to Matt Fonslow, diagnosing the aftermarket A to Z on the Aftermarket Radio Network. Follow Matt on your favorite listening app. He's very interested in what you have to say. Let him know what you'd like him to cover and come on the show. Matt is all for advancing the aftermarket. Find Matt Fonslow on social media and connect or on aftermarketradionetwork.com.